Chapter 3. Reading Ancient Egypt.
"I've got it!" a panting Jean-Francois Champollion cried out as he fainted at his brother's feet. Champollion had discovered the complex grammar of ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs and had solved a centuries-old mystery. Napoleon's scientists, Giovanni Belzoni, and many others had studied the inscriptions on the Rosetta Stone without success. The ancient Egyptians and their pharaohs were anonymous, people without history. Who were the kings depicted in temple inscriptions? Who were the gods and goddesses receiving their offerings? Who were the important people buried in richly decorated tombs close to the pyramids of Giza? Belzoni and his contemporaries operated in an archaeological fog. At first, the experts wrongly assumed that the glyphs were picture symbols. Then, in the 1790s, a Danish scholar called Jürgen Zoga came up with a theory that the scripts represented not objects, but sounds, that they were a way of turning human speech into writing, a phonetic script. The discovery in 1799 of the Rosetta Stone, with its two hieroglyphic texts, was a major step forward. One text was in a formal writing system that no one could unlock, but the other was a simplified script used by ordinary people. This was clearly an alphabetic version of hieroglyphs, and is now known to have been widely used by scribes. The Rosetta Stone was the first breakthrough. A second was the work of Thomas Young, an English doctor and expert in languages and mathematics. His knowledge of ancient Greek allowed him to read one inscription. This enabled him to go on to identify the pharaoh Ptolemy V's name within six cartouches, a group of hieroglyphs within an oval, representing the name of a monarch, in the Rosetta inscriptions. He then matched the hieroglyphs to the letters of the Greek spelling of the pharaoh's name. Unfortunately, though, Young assumed that most hieroglyphs were non-phonetic, and so his efforts to read them ultimately failed. Young's great rival was Jean-Francois Champollion, 1790-1832, a linguistic genius with a volcanic personality. The son of an impoverished bookseller, Champollion didn't begin formal education until he was 8 years old, but he soon displayed a remarkable talent for drawing and languages. By the age of 17, he had mastered Arabic, Hebrew, and Sanskrit, as well as English, German, and Italian. The young Champollion was obsessed with hieroglyphs. He also learned Coptic, believing that the language of Christian Egypt might have retained some ancient Egyptian elements. In 1807, Champollion and his brother, Jacques Joseph, moved to Paris, where they lived in poverty. The young linguist turned his attention to the Rosetta Stone. He studied it for months and pored over numerous Egyptian papyri, documents written on papyrus reed stems. The research was frustrating and full of dead ends. Unlike Young, Champollion became convinced that Egyptian script was phonetic. He widened his study to include both Egyptian and Greek papyri, as well as an obelisk from Upper Egypt with cartouches of Queen Cleopatra. In 1822, he received accurate copies of the hieroglyphs at Abu Simbel, which allowed him to identify the cartouches representing Ramses II and then another pharaoh, Thutmose III. He realized that hieroglyphic writing did not include vowels. There were 24 symbols that represented single consonants, much like letters in English, and that functioned like an alphabet. The script was usually, but not always, written from right to left. No blanks or punctuation marks separated words. By the time Champollion rushed into his brother's room, he had deciphered a script that he called, at times, figurative, symbolic, and phonetic. On September 27, 1822, Champollion presented his findings to the French Academy of Inscriptions and Literature. The discovery was considered so important that the King of France was informed. However, years were to pass before Champollion's work was universally accepted. In 1824, he published a summary of hieroglyphs that was savaged by his critics. It seems likely that his argumentative personality and inability to tolerate criticism added to his difficulties. Champollion became curator of the Egyptian section at the Louvre, where his knowledge of hieroglyphs allowed him to arrange the collections in their correct time order. This was a major advance. But the man who had unlocked the formal script of ancient Egypt had never visited the Nile. In 1828, influential supporters persuaded the king to back a joint French and Tuscan expedition under Champollion's leadership. 30 years after Napoleon's experts sailed for Alexandria, Jean-François Champollion, Egyptologist Ippolito Rossellini, and a team of artists, draftsmen, and architects, all wearing Turkish clothing, which was more comfortable in the heat, embarked on a journey up the river. The expedition was a triumph. For the first time, the master and his companions could read the inscriptions on temple walls and understand the significance of some of the oldest monuments in the world. At the goddess Hathor's temple at Dendera, excited members of the expedition jumped ashore one bright moonlit night. For 2 glorious hours, they wandered through the ruins, only returning to their boats at 3 o'clock in the morning. After brief stays at Luxor, Karnak, and in the Valley of the Kings, the expedition rode the summer flood down to Cairo in triumph. Champollion was the first scholar to identify tomb owners and to translate the inscriptions on temple walls of pharaohs making offerings to gods. Exhausted, he returned to Paris in January 1830. He would die of a stroke 2 years later at the age of just 42. But the controversy surrounding hieroglyphs continued long after his death. And 15 years would pass before everyone agreed that his translations had been correct. A flock of less scrupulous visitors descended on the Nile. The success of Belzoni and Dravetti encouraged other treasure hunters to seek fame and fortune there. Ancient Egypt rapidly became a money-making enterprise. Champollion was disgusted at the destruction. People were openly robbing tombs for their treasures, digging up statues and hammering art off temple walls, all with a view simply to make a profit. He wrote to Muhammad Ali to complain about the antiquities trade and the damage being done. Champollion's letter was the trigger for Ali to pass a law that forbade the export of antiquities, to authorize the construction of a museum, and to make it illegal to destroy monuments. Without officials in place, the law meant nothing. But it was a move in the right direction, even if Ali and his successors did give or sell most of the museum exhibits to prominent foreigners. Fortunately, a few visitors now started to come to the Nile in search of information rather than artifacts. Champollion's dramatic claims to have deciphered the hieroglyphs encouraged a move towards research rather than collecting. At last, there was a way of learning the secrets of ancient Egyptian civilization. Influential scholars, like the classical archaeologist and traveler Sir William Gell, encouraged promising young men. One was John Gardner Wilkinson, 1797 to 1875, whose parents had died when he was young and left him modest private funds. While awaiting an officer's commission in the army, he went on a tour to Mediterranean lands. In Rome, he met Sir William Gell, who probably knew more than anyone about ancient Egypt at the time. Young Wilkinson arrived in Alexandria in late 1821, armed with a little Arabic and boundless enthusiasm. This was shortly before Champollion deciphered Egyptian script. But Wilkinson knew enough of Thomas Young's approach to hieroglyphs and of Egyptian artifacts to be better prepared than anyone before him. He traveled upstream and threw himself into Egyptology. Here was a different kind of archaeologist. While Belzoni and his kind were excavators, digging for art and artifacts, Wilkinson took a much broader view of Egyptology. In this, he was far ahead of his time. he realized that the civilization and people of ancient Egypt could only be understood by combining archaeological finds and inscriptions. Wilkinson had no interest in acquiring artifacts. He was a copyist of inscriptions, monuments, and tombs, a true student of the past. Though done freehand, his work was remarkably accurate by modern standards, especially his drawings of hieroglyphs, which were better than those of Napoleon's experts. For the next 12 years, Wilkinson traveled widely throughout the Nile Valley and into the desert. Sometimes he was alone or just with his friend James Burton. At other times, a small number of like-minded archaeologists and artists would join him. To ensure their safety in this remote land, they adopted Turkish ways and passed themselves off as Muslims, even to their servants. Wilkinson worked at first without any knowledge of the glyphs. But in 1823, Gell sent him a copy of Champollion's summary. This made him realize just how much progress the young Frenchman had made. But as he got better at comparing Coptic and ancient Egyptian words, Wilkinson came to realize that Champollion was careless. He had made terrible mistakes with inscriptions that he deciphered. Wilkinson never met Champollion, but he disliked the way the Frenchman sought fame while tolerating no criticism of his work. He was secretive, quarreled violently with other scholars, and made false claims about his research. Wilkinson, by contrast, preferred to stay in the background, quietly sketching, recording, and working on the dating of temples and tombs. Once he had acquired a working knowledge of hieroglyphs, the ever-curious Wilkinson moved on to other research. From 1827, he spent most of his time on the west bank of the Nile at Luxor. There, he occupied the tomb of a high official named Amichu, 15th century B.C., living in considerable style and enjoying magnificent views across the Nile Valley. He put down carpets, erected partitions to create rooms, and installed his personal library. He would entertain his friends, burning wooden mummy cases in the hearth to keep warm, as everyone did. Not the done thing today. Wilkinson was not a morning person. He would breakfast at 10:30. But he accomplished an astonishing amount, including creating the first maps of the West Bank cemeteries. He numbered the tombs in the Valley of the Kings, and his system is still used today. He concentrated on the tombs of nobles, realizing that they provided rich insights into Egyptian life. The monuments offered a chance to travel back in time and to live, as it were, among the people, as though you were a spectator watching the events unfolding on the walls. I love exploring Egyptian tomb paintings, even if they are often very faded today. You can witness life on the nobles' estates, laborers gathering in the harvest under the watchful eye of a scribe, cattle being butchered, and brightly clothed guests gathering for a feast. There is even a charming painting of a nobleman fishing, accompanied by his cats. Wilkinson was one of a small group of scholars who placed Egyptology on a firm footing during the 1820s and 1830s. They were serious researchers with a passion for their work and for the knowledge that came from it. They worked both together and independently. Wilkinson himself left Egypt in 1833 with an idea for a book about the lives of the ancient Egyptians. Manners and Customs of the Ancient Egyptians appeared in 1837 and sold well, its reasonable price bringing it within reach of the middle class. The book took readers on a journey in time through ancient Egypt, providing a wealth of information. Its people were brought alive thanks to details acquired from paintings, papyri, and inscriptions. Wilkinson had the rare gift of being able to communicate important, original research to a wide audience. He became a household name and was knighted by Queen Victoria. Champollion and Wilkinson were a new breed of scholar. They painted a vivid portrait of a colorful, vigorous civilization, and both realized that archaeology alone could not reconstruct ancient civilizations. Any serious research depended on teamwork between excavators and the people who worked on inscriptions and written records. Wilkinson's brilliant popular account of the Egyptians placed the serious study of the world's earliest civilizations center stage. Wholesale destruction along the Nile slowly gave way to more disciplined research. 6 decades were to pass before new copyists came to the Nile, but thanks to Champollion and Wilkinson, they were professionals.